Welcome back to the program. Creative destruction has impacted every aspect of society, from how and what we buy, the movies we see, how we listen to music and watch entertainment, mail, shopping, how we do virtually everything has changed. So it should come as no surprise then that it's all changing with respect to the way we do politics. The only question is, why has it taken so long, and why hasn't it been reported, and how will it affect who leads us and the kind of democracy we have? We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Sasha Eisenberg. He's a columnist for Slate and the Washington correspondent for Monocle. He covered the 2008 election as a national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times Magazine. And it is my pleasure to welcome Sasha Eisenberg here to talk about his new book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. Sasha Eisenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Really looking at the way in which a lot of this technology and a lot of this psychological work has been brought to campaigns, it really seems like that the 2004 Bush reelection campaign was kind of the beginning of this process in a fundamental way. Talk a little about that.
I think that's right. And I think it's worth looking back one election before that and the extent to which the 2000 experience sort of shaped the problems that campaigns have been trying to solve. I think we very much sort of live in the shadow of Florida right now. Two things were revealed at the end of 2000 that I think still sort of define our politics. One is how polarized in partisan terms the electorate is. I write in the book about how Matthew Dowd, who was Bush's chief pollster, started writing a memo even before the Supreme Court had decided in Bush v. Gore, looking ahead to what Bush's reelection strategy would be. And he noted that it wouldn't be an election that was decided in the way that we had traditionally thought of them for the decades before, which was sort of looking for swing voters in the middle, sort of classic Clinton style move towards 50%. Dowd was arguing that the two sides were so hardened that it would be what he called a mobilization election, that Republicans would need to sort of organize their coalition and find people who supported them but weren't habitual voters yet. And then the closeness of that election, you know, put a value on really small improvements. And so as innovations took place in the years that came that got you 1 or 2 or 3% better, either through these experiments that I write about that people have used to sort of define what actually moves voters and new data that allows them to target more sharply, campaigns that might have rolled their eyes at investing in research that would yield insights of 2% after Florida weren't laughing at that anymore. And so what happened in the years in the sort of Bush world and at the RNC between 2000 and 2004 was this sort of two-pronged question. One, what exactly does it take to contact and mobilize people who already support you to turn out to vote? And sort of secondarily, how do you isolate the people who need to be persuaded and what do you do with them? And then how do you find them? And all these things sort of came together, new data, new database powers, statistical modeling, and sort of utterly transformed politics in those 4 years.
As we are so polarized and so evenly divided, and the difference in all of these elections, be they local elections, state elections, or national elections, becomes about such a small number of voters, all of these techniques take on so much more power.
Right. I mean, so there's a small number. It's worth thinking of voters in two categories. In campaigns, people think of the voters that they're trying to reach as one of two things. Either they are turnout targets, which are people who already support you but are not necessarily likely or certain to vote. They're just sort of not. You know, once people start voting, they tend to vote pretty predictably. But people who are not habitual voters, in this case, we're talking about, you know, people who voted for the first time in 2008, came out for Barack Obama, but didn't vote before and haven't voted since. So turnout targets are the it's a sort of behavioral challenge. I don't need to change your mind, but I need to get you to do something that you're not used to doing. The other set is called persuasion targets. These are people who are likely to vote. They vote regularly. They just haven't made up their minds, or they can be persuaded to change them. And so the sliver of, you know, what campaigns call persuadables is what's really small. But we see, you know, in all these polls that are 48, 46, or 47, 45, you know, that's 6 or 8% undecided in those polls. And then maybe campaigns think that, you know, there are 3 or 5% soft Obama supporters who could theoretically be persuaded to defect to Romney or vice versa. That's still, you know, only 12, 15% of the electorate whose sort of opinions are up for grabs. But the other 85% many of them, their sort of behaviors are up for grabs. And a lot of what I'm writing about is people using sort of behavioral science techniques not to change people's opinions, but to sort of shift their behaviors.
And when looking at shifting those behaviors, it's not necessarily issue-driven. It's people's voting habits are socially driven. It's a social exercise, and that's what a lot of these experts are trying to get at.
Yeah, this is, I think, the big intellectual breakthrough that all of this research, when sort of stacked on top of one another, has sort of revealed, is how little politics campaigns these days are or should be about sort of changing opinions, how much changing behaviors. And a lot of what I write about is people taking insights that have come out of behavioral psychology that over the years have been used to understand how people process economic decisions, for example, have been sort of slow to migrate to politics, but people using these randomized control trials, which are basically pharmaceutical trials for politics, where instead of giving out drugs and placebos randomly, campaigns are randomly assigning robocalls or pieces of mail or web ads, and then measuring the effect on voters, are realizing that you can nudge voters' behaviors, often through sort of, you know, reminding them of the social dynamics around voting, and that those tend to be pretty universal. And it doesn't really, you know, that there are things that sort of, you know, unite us psychologically as people that aren't necessarily split on partisan or demographic lines, the traditional categories in which we tend to talk about the electorate.
One of the things that's led to this is the degree to which money has become more important, and this nexus between fundraising and getting out the vote, the way in which the fundraising efforts have really led into the get out the vote efforts.
Yeah, you know, I think that people are being smarter about trying to assess how money affects campaigns. Obviously, you know, California, there are plenty of examples of people throwing a lot of money at campaigns and not winning them. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to be skeptical of the idea that there's a direct line between the more money you have or the more ads you put on TV and getting results. And we know still very little about the effect of ads. Which remains the largest line item in just about every budget of a campaign of any size in the country. It's very hard to isolate the effect of campaign advertising when people are buying across a whole media market or whole state at different levels. What campaigns have, or sort of researchers, both in academia and in the campaign world, have been able to figure out in the last decade is the value of individual level contact. You know, what campaigns call voter contact, which are things like phone or mail or individual visits by canvassers or web ads. It can be individually targeted, and then you can measure the individual impact through these experiments. And their campaigns have been able to put a price on, you know, the cost per net vote, the cost per registration, the cost to mobilize somebody. And, you know, there's a sort of moneyball quality to pricing these things that until a decade ago, campaigns didn't really know what to do. And so pricing the impact of TV ads remains really tough, but pricing these sort of, you know, more tactile direct forms of communication it is now doable. And I think that's one reason we've often looked at this last, you know, decade or so in politics and seen a series of campaigns that had sort of big volunteer cultures attached to them, the Dean campaign in 2003, the Bush reelection in 2004, Obama in 2008. We've often sort of, I think, talked about them solely from the perspective of, like, supply of volunteer energy. These were charismatic candidates who had a sense of movement about them, and people just, like, rushed out of their houses wanting to help, and there was some truth to all that. But on the other end, inside campaigns demanded the manpower because they were finally able to put a value on what it was worth to have somebody knock on a single door, and partly because they had the data to be really smart about knowing which doors to knock on. And that's, I think, changed how campaigns look at their budget now.
And this is the whole issue of micro-targeting and really defining who the voters are and who the voters are that you need to get out.
Right. And so, you know, the breakthrough that started to take place in that period between 2000 and 2004 is that people started to be able to merge the very limited information about you that's on your voter registration form, which is usually your name, your age, your gender, in states that have party registration, that, and then, like, a list of the elections in which you've turned out, with all the information that was being accumulated in commercial databases that was being used, you know, in the 80s and 90s to develop credit rating scores for people, to use by direct mail catalogs to figure out who they should mail to, that was used by charities to figure out where they should prospect for donations. And after 2000, the political world had success sort of acquiring that information and merging it with their voter databases. And so all of a sudden you went from having maybe a few dozen data points for each voter at the most to hundreds, now thousands of data points. And so the big breakthrough was when campaigns started doing statistical models, basically running algorithms through all of those thousands of data points that they have for every voter in the country, and then matching it up with what they were seeing in their polling about the attributes of voters who believed a certain thing or were interested in the election, and were able to find sort of patterns that weren't perceptible to the naked eye. And so campaigns no longer had to talk about voters in the traditional geographic boundaries of, you know, a precinct or a county or a district, or the big demographic categories that we see in polls, like gender, age, or if you have a college education or not. And they could see the sort of delicate interplay of lots of different variables, from like whether you have a hunting license to the density of the census tract you live in. And now campaigns have developed an individual level prediction. And so the Obama campaign has a prediction that they have that's defined as a percentage out of 100 that is their likelihood, their expectation of the likelihood that you will vote for Barack Obama. And it'll be different than if other people in your house will have a different score and your neighbors will have a different score. And so when the campaign goes out to send mail or send somebody a knock on your door, they're assessing you at an individual level and not just sort of as a function of the old geography or old demographic categories that we used to use to define people.
The other thing that's come together in this is the way in which campaigns have merged off and online behavior.
Right. This is the biggest thing that's happening in this particular cycle, just since 2008. You know, we saw people starting to use the internet sort of aggressively in 2004 to enlist volunteers and for donations. But the problem was using it for political persuasion or mobilization was that you didn't know who somebody on your website was in sort of political terms. They signed up, they gave you your email address or their mobile phone number, but your real political identity it exists in the offline world, and it's attached to your home address, that you vote in a precinct near your house. That's the space, and that's where your voter registration record sort of belongs. And so campaigns didn't do a lot of real political communication online other than trying to raise money, because they didn't really know who they were talking to. And the risk of mobilizing one of your opponent's supporters or wasting time communicating with people who already support you, that's costly for a campaign. And what the big technical breakthrough has been being able to take cookies, which are these sort of invisible files that travel with somebody as they browse the internet, and match those to your voter registration record. And so now campaigns are often able to serve particular ads to voters based on what they know about you in their databases, what party you are, whether you vote in primaries, your age, your race, and sort of start communicating online with the same level of specificity that they do when they're calling you during dinner or sending somebody to knock on your door.
Talk a little bit about what your reporting tells you about the conflicts within campaign organizations between the old-time political pro who works on gut instinct and feeling and the way political campaigns have worked for so long, and this whole new wave of political operatives who are using these metrics, using this information to really redefine how campaigns work.
Yeah, I mean, this is the big tension that's sort of at the heart of the story I tell, and I'm telling that exists in some form in every industry. You know, I mean, I think Moneyball showed it in mm-hmm. sports pretty vividly. I think that we've sort of seen in the finance Wall Street world the sort of tension, obviously, not always with great success for our economy, between sort of, you know, new generation quants and old style traders. And in politics, there are sort of peculiar pathologies to political campaigns. It's, you know, the number keeps on going up. So that in my book, I claim that this would be a $6 billion annual industry this year. I think I underestimated how much money super PACs would raise and spend, so we're probably going to be closer to $8 billion spent on politics this year on American campaigns. And it's a campaigns are really bad companies to be spending that much money. I mean, so when you think about it, you know, campaign is basically a corporation that often exists for 6 months, 12 months, or, you know, in rare cases, 18 months. They tend to, the chairman or the CEO is a candidate who often tends to be one of two types of people. Either they've done it before and they think they know how to do it and aren't going to do anything new, or they've never done it before, in which case there's no good reason why, like, a county judge or a state legislator should have any idea how to run for Congress. It's not a natural skill set for anybody except for political professionals. And so candidates are often completely in hock to the consultants that they hire for their campaigns. And consultants are rarely held accountable for their failures. I've, you know, covered enough of these campaigns to know that if you call around the morning after an election, if the campaign won and you call the consultant, he or she will almost always find a way to personally take credit for the victory. So it'll be like, so what happened? And it's like, oh, we were down 4 points the weekend before the election. I saw we were really trailing with women, so I made all of our direct mail pieces pink, the mail consultant will tell you. And then, you know, our next poll had us up 8 points among women. And then, you know, if they lose and you call the mail consultant, like, you won't hear anything about the pink mail, but it'll be, oh, the candidate was horrible. It was a horrible year to be running as a Republican. The economy was bad. And so there's, like, you know, there's sort of attributing blame or credit was really impossible. And campaigns never invested in sort of basic research R&D type stuff because nobody wanted to put aside money or sort of distract from what they thought was an urgent job with the idea of learning lessons after the election. And so you had these companies that existed for a few months that cared about market share on some random Tuesday in November. And they tended never to learn from themselves. They kept on doing the same things over and over again. And so these two sort of big tools, these usually these field experiments and a level of individual data has allowed campaigns to be more empirical. And it doesn't mean that that's being well received everywhere, but I spent a couple chapters in the book on the Obama 08 campaign, which was one, I think in part because there was a sense of mission from Obama and David Plouffe, the campaign manager, on down, that because they were running against the sort of Democratic establishment and Hillary Clinton, that they could also sort of run against the traditional norms of the consulting profession. And I think that 08 campaign and this re-election effort are sort of emblematic of a campaign that is doing its best to sort of internalize empiricism using these tools and not just rely on gut instinct or precedent tradition to make decisions.
And, of course, the penultimate example, I suppose, of a candidate that's completely disconnected from the process, but yet for whom the process of all of this new kind of marketing has served him well, is Rick Perry down in Texas.
Yeah, it seems really weird to be saying this after everything we saw from Rick Perry last year, but the most sort of intellectually sophisticated, scholarly campaign that's ever been waged in the United States was Rick Perry's 2006 re-election for governor of Texas. And I write about his top political advisor, this guy Dave Carney, who's this sort of massive, profane, sort of journeyman, mercenary political consultant who had been around long enough that he had just grown skeptical of a lot of the other consultants he worked with. And so he was the general consultant, which is sort of like being the contractor at a construction site. So he would, you know, do the equivalent of bringing in the carpenter and the stonemason and stuff. And he sort of thought all of them were, none of them were being held accountable, and all of them were selling him things that he had no way of whose efficiency or impact he had no way of assessing. And so when he heard that there were these political scientists at Yale who had started running these randomized field experiments, he thought, wow, this might give me a way to basically audit the people that I bring in to sort of do specialized services for the campaign. And he was looking ahead to spending $40 million on Perry's race in Texas in 2006. And he bought these two political scientists, who brought two others in, and these four guys who became known as the eggheads in the campaign were given free license by Carney and by Perry. And their mandate was, hey, anything in this campaign that we're spending money on or spending time on that you can find a way to successfully randomize and measure, go ahead and do it with the idea that, you know, the campaign will be able to sort of cut out waste or inefficiency and be smarter about how it spent money. And once again, it's amazing from the vantage of, you know, the Rick Perry who couldn't remember three things, say this, but Rick Perry's political career is, you know, directly sponsored more pieces of like peer-reviewed, published academic research than any other politician in American history.
Talk a little bit about the responsibility of political journalists to cover this and to really understand what's going on, because right now it is severely undercovered.
Yeah, the common critique of campaign coverage is you guys just cover the horse race. You don't cover policy. You don't cover, deeply the candidates' records. You don't do a good job talking about what any of this means for governing. And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, a lot of political coverage is silly and superficial and doesn't really get it at the sort of policy consequences of elections. I think there's another problem, which is the horse race coverage isn't that good at actually covering this as a sporting contest. Political campaigns are more or less written and talked about by the media in exactly the same way that they were talked about in the late 80s. We keep on covering the same parts of the campaign, the rallies, the campaign ads, what the pollsters tell us and conference calls. And this sort of world of research and new tools and direct individual contact that isn't taking place on TV is something that journalists are either oblivious to or have sort of given up on because it's opaque. It's hard to sort of get your hands on. And so I think we don't do a good job of covering this contest. Like, the decisions that are being made in campaign headquarters in Boston or Chicago are often not the ones that people are talking about on MSNBC or CNN or in the paper on a given day. And campaigns have gotten a lot more intellectually sophisticated, have new tools that we don't know or understand or sort of technically advanced, and journalists are falling behind. And it's a real problem, and one that I think the gap between what the sophistication of the people inside campaigns and the people like me who try to cover them, is that gap's going to grow. And it's going to be very difficult for us to explain to readers and viewers and listeners how and why campaigns are doing what they're doing, how they're spending all this money, why they're making the decisions they're making, because the sort of underlying base of knowledge and thinking is just increasingly out of our reach.
We've talked about how important this is in close races, in a very divided country, in a very divided political situation. To what extent can all of this information, all of this knowledge, be used to help a candidate that's way far behind or really make a bad candidate successful?
Probably not at all. I one of the sort of main characters in the book is this behavioral psychologist named Todd Rogers, who introduced a lot of these behavioral science experiments to politics. And when he starts to work with a new client or group to collaborate on running a study through their existing programs, he always makes this point, which is, look, we can find marginal improvements, and some of them are things that can increase turnout by 5 or 8%, which is a big deal. But you're never going to change the sort of underlying structure of a race. A bad candidate is still probably going to be a bad candidate. An unfavorable sort of environment in which to run is going to be what it is. Partisanship at the individual level is very predictable. So, getting, especially at sort of high level races where partisan expectations are pretty set, it's very hard to get a Democrat to vote for a Republican, for example, or an independent who tends to vote as a Republican to vote Democratic. And so there are limits to what any of this stuff can do. The thing that makes this important now is that, you don't have to look far to find a race where 2 or 3% is going to be really important to the future of this country. And I think people who work in politics are increasingly realizing that it's at their own peril that they, sort of scoff at that.
Sasha Eisenberg, his book is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. Sasha, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.